Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the guy who's the social outcast at special school, and despite everyone telling you from the off that you'd be bad at it, turns out I'm the very best in the class. Oh, and the hot guy likes me. Duncan Nickel.
Yes, this week we read Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yarros. One of the biggest fantasy novels in the world right now, and something that I have been putting off for a while, but I knew we had to confront eventually.
This is a very interesting book to approach. Firstly, as you say, it's one of the biggest. I don't think I've had anything have the same buzz since A Court of Thorns and Roses. This is very much, everyone's talking about it, and it's in this really weird space where I'm both simultaneously being told by very loud voices that this is the hot new shit and this is just the shit. Sorry, that's still good in this modern language. It's shite. Like, people like it's amazing, and equally loud people like this is the worst thing to ever happen to fantasy. And I was so confused going in. I did not know what I was going to get.
I wasn't really sure what your reaction to it was going to be either, Duncan. My opinion after coming through it is definitely different from what I had going in. But before we get into our discussion, have you been reading anything this week?
No, not particularly. This has been a very single track week for me. Despite getting through this book at quite a good pace, any extra time I had, I actually jumped on our next book, which we already announced in our last episode, which will be Empire of the Dawn, The final book in the Empire of the Vampire series. So once I was off Fourth Wing, I just started plugging my way through that. There was something that happened this week that I want to kind of share it with you.
Okay.
So, last Friday, my partner had her cousin round and her partner for a nice dinner party, board games after, lovely time. And a conversation came up, okay, about how much a fan I was of, like, Star Wars and, oh God, I'm going to see how many Star Wars books have you read? And I'm like, well, maybe, like, 30. And then my partner just chimed in and was like, no, definitely at least 30, probably more. I was like, yeah, guilty.
Sure.
But then I got asked a question about, like, what do you prefer? Like, Star Wars or Lord of the Rings? And I was like, okay, before I answer this, do the people at the table want to have a guess? Geordie, what do you think would be the answer?
I think that you have to reject the premise, right? It's apples and oranges. They're not remotely comparable.
Do you know what? That would have been a far more sophisticated approach.
Yeah, because the enjoyment you get out of watching a Star Wars movie is not the same as you get from reading Lord of the Rings. Now, maybe you could argue the films are more comparable because they're much more action-focused, but there's not really a lot that they have in common, really, aside from being, like, Heroes' Journeys,
they're still cross-media. You know, I've played Star Wars games, I've played Lord of the Rings games, I've read Lord of the Rings, I've read Star Wars books. You know, they are technically in the same format, as in they're both English. So it was really hard, and I was writing to myself, like, what do you all think? And my girlfriend was just like, it's clearly Lord of the Rings. Like, The Hobbit's his favourite book. And I was like, yeah, you're right, The Hobbit is my favourite book. Like, that's the answer to the question. And then her cousin's partner was like, probably Star Wars, given the amount of stuff he's consumed. And then my partner's cousin, I think, actually kind of nailed me. They kind of just stood there and went, I reckon you really want to say Lord of the Rings, because that's the far more sophisticated and, like, work of literature. But you're ashamed to admit that, like, through sheer hours and, like, moment-to-moment enjoyment, you're probably actually Star Wars. And I sat there and went, oh God, you've got me banged to rights. Like, I really want to say Lord of the Rings. But the answer is, Jordy, like, I have read so much Star Wars, and I know so much Star Wars lore. The Silmarillion bores me.
Sure.
I can't hack it. Like, it's not like I've read the history of the Lord of Middle-earth, volumes 1 to 18. I've read The Hobbit, I've read Lord of the Rings, they're cracker, but I'm not a legendarium guy.
Well, I guess I'm glad that you found this out about yourself, even if it is a sort of sorry, hard-to-swallow truth. And also, like, there's a lot of really crap Star Wars out there, Duncan. You don't think that on the average you can say, like, yeah, it's just, like, it's really a hit and miss. Even, like, good Star Wars is not as good as Lord of the Rings.
No, it's clearly not. But do I spend more of my time, like, enveloped in Star Wars. Is that the measure?
I don't think it is the measure. Like, I've watched more of House than I have of, I don't know, It's a Wonderful Life, because there's more House. Doesn't mean that I think it's better than It's a Wonderful Life. It's not.
See, this is an argument we've gone round and round. What? How do you define what you think is good versus what your favourite is? I don't know, mate. I feel like I may have discovered an upsetting truth about myself.
I hope it doesn't plunge you into falling to the dark side. Thank you for sharing, Duncan.
How are you being, mate?
I have also not read anything else this week because I picked up Empire of the Dawn as soon as I could. But also, this really did take me a while to get through. I had to dedicate a lot of time to this book, you know, and actually getting it down. I had to do it in multiple formats as well. But I made it through. I finished it in time for the episode. And and I don't want to share anything else this week, but I do want to quickly ask you, Duncan, if you're kind of aware of, like, some of the, you know, the big thing, the big news in the fantasy world that is happening right now as we're recording on the 9th of November, 2025.
I'm going to go with no. I suppose the answer isn't that the new Witcher series wasn't that bad.
First of all, that's not what I've heard, but I don't want to talk about The Witcher. No, what I think
is...
What is it? Used the words Feast for Crows?
Oh, wait, no, this is the AI art scandal.
Yes, right. So, at the time of recording, George R. R. Martin nor his publishers have commented on this, but the recently released illustrated edition of A Feast for Crows may, it's suspected by many who, you know, have eyes, that the art within is AI generated and it's not actually the genuine work of the artist supposedly behind it. Have you seen the art yourself, Duncan?
I have not seen the art itself. I have seen several commentators on it. And I have also heard, because this is the big thing, is that it's just suspected. No one's put their hand up yet and gone, yeah, what can I say?
That's right. There's been no comment from either the publishers or Martin. The irony, of course, is that George R. R. Martin is currently in a lawsuit with generative AI companies like ChatGPT for pirating his work, you know, that ChatGPT can generate you scenes from a prospective future Game of Thrones book because they've read his book, they fed it into their machine, and now it can be used to plagiarize him. That's his legal argument. And now, of course, the irony is that a publication has gone out with his name on it, which is potentially full of AI art. I have seen the art myself, Duncan. I've gone through. I think that the commentators are right. I think it is AI art. Sometimes these things can be kind of hard to tell. This doesn't feel hard to tell, especially this one art of Lady Stoneheart. Just like, this doesn't look like a person artist. This looks, there's something wrong with it. And none of the characters really resemble what they're supposed to look like in terms of description. You have characters like Cersei who are wearing blue, and you're like, well, that's very strange, because if I was an artist, I would unquestionably put her in red and gold, because those are her colours, you know. Even if it wasn't true to the outfit she would be wearing in that scene, if you have a limited number of occasions in which to draw Cersei, you would probably draw her with the clothes that do the colour scheme, the colour theme, which would be most appropriate. The art's also just bad. It's genuinely bad. Even if it wasn't AI-generated or wasn't obviously AI-generated, this would be a serious letdown to people who had pre-ordered. And it's disappointing on the whole. I've also checked out the artist's who's supposedly behind it website, and it doesn't really resemble his art.
Well, this is disappointing. And I have many sort of conflicting opinions around the use of AI as a tool, particularly just from an engineering standpoint. There are many areas in industry, in STEM industries, where it is incredibly powerful. When it comes to the creative arts, though, I get very let down, more so than anything, not from its existence, but from the idea that when you pay money, there is an kind of an implicit expectation that you're paying money to receive a human crafted piece. It's mm-hmm. like when you go to the fair and it's like, I don't know, I've got a key ring and I bought it at my local like summer fete, and it might not be like the most technically beautiful thing in the world, but it was at this handcrafted guy's stall. He had all his stuff there, you know, it was his piece of expressive art. And mm-hmm. that yeah. gave it more value than maybe the wood itself. If I'd known that had just been run off, he just brought them bulk from, you know, a factory in China, mm-hmm. I would have felt missold. Even if technically he never said it was handcrafted. Like, there was just the assumption with what I was being sold. And that's what really gets me here. People have bought this illustrated version of the book because it has an artist's name, on it. You're assuming that artist has actually drawn said art.
Anyway, we only have to wait around to see how this plays out. It's definitely intriguing to me, but I think we should crack on with this book because it is a hefty boy, so we got a lot to cover.
I'd say at the time of release, George R. Martin and his team have responded. They have denied allegations of use of AI art, and we will discuss this on the next episode, Empire of the Dawn.
Yes, back to Fourth Wing. So, Geordie, ahead of this recording, I took a moment. So Fourth Wing, actually, let's lay the groundwork for the two people listening that don't already know about it. Fourth Wing is the cutting edge of YA romanticy out at the moment. It's the big name, and what's so cool about it is that it's the 2020s version of Dragon Riders of Pern. It is about a young woman who goes Absolutely. Off to learn to be a dragon rider. She meets a hot man commander along the way, and they do it in detail, and then there are fight scenes
in a lot of detail.
Oh my god, I was not prepared for that level of detail.
Now I was really surprised by that one, and I would like to apologize formally, Duncan, for before getting to that scene sending a message being like, would you like to, is this the episode where you'd like to invite your sister?
Absolutely
on?
I'm glad I didn't even broach the matter. Let's do just kind of general impressions, shall we?
Before we do that, I want to chime in on one simple thing, Duncan, which is going to be important going forward. And I have to make a very slight correction to something you said.
Go on.
You said this book is YA. It's not.
It's a young adult protagonist?
Not really. The character's 20. She's not a child. No, this book is not YA. This book is NA.
New adult?
New adult. New adult is a very new marketing term for books. The idea being that it is in format, in layout, in style, it's almost identical to a YA book. So it has themes along like coming of age in a way, even though the characters are older, they're now like actually allowed to be adults. They're not teens. Violet is 20 in this, and she's only going to get older as the books go on. But it's allowed to have explicit sex. There's a lot of swearing. The F word gets used all the time. And, I mean, I guess those are literally the only differences. Explicit sex and swear
words. Basically, in YA, you kind of, because YA, by the name, would like traditionally be marketed to teens. It's like, right, we've discovered now that actually a lot of YA is being consumed by the 25 to 35 year old. Let's pivot and like expressly target them.
Yeah, exactly. So Violet is supposed to be more relevant, more emotionally and biographically close to her actual readers. So that clarification out of the way. Yes, Duncan. Overall thoughts of this book?
Oh, I've been preparing for this one. I've gone through this several times in my head, how to communicate this. I started reading this book and come page, 20, I was already groaning. It was felt hack. Mm. There were moments, there were scenes, there's a real kicker scene that I've mentioned to so many people where a character literally says to our protagonist, good luck at Dragon Rider school, but whatever you do, stay away from this bad boy. And then the first thing she does when she walks in the class is, who's that hottie?
Yeah.
Oh no, he's the bad boy. I was like, guys, is this the level? Is this the level? And so I was kind of set up to be in that really negative mindset. The problem is, Geordie, I really had a nice time. And despite many faults in what I felt sometimes in the writing, in the scenes, particularly sometimes in quite a bit of redundancy throughout, and there were grown moments, I cannot deny that I became emotionally invested. There were scenes, particularly of one quite late on, where a character falls off their dragon and they're plummeting to their death, and my heart rate went up. I felt so tense reading this. And there are scenes when our character triumphs, aww, and I really wanted to punch the air. And there are scenes where they're set back and someone's being an arsehole to them, again, for no explicit reason, again. And I genuinely felt the frustration that the character felt. Like, it got me on an emotional level, and that deserves kudos.
I'd like to share with you, Duncan, my journey to this book. I was aware of it when it came out. It had a reputation. I was like, okay, this seems like not really something I want to be that interested in. It has a mix of good reviews and bad reviews. The bad reviews seem to be bringing up issues which I would which I have. Last year, shortly after the second book had come out, and it came out very quickly after the first, I picked up, you know, the sample chapter on Audible, and I genuinely could not get through it. It was so painfully poorly written. It felt juvenile in the, especially the first way it was written in, like, first person present tense. And I was like, people don't think like this. This feels like a parody of YA fantasy books. It's just embarrassing. And then the next day, maybe a couple of days later, it's my girlfriend's birthday. We're in a bookshop in town in Waterstones. I take it off the shelf and I show it to her and I say, read the first page. And she reads it through and she's like, oh, this is a bit, like, silly. And I was like, yeah. And I go on this railing thing about how I just painfully found the opening chapter, how I couldn't stand it. Later that evening, we're at her birthday party. One of her best friends gives her a package. She opens it up, and it's Fourth Wing. And then I'm like, oh, whoops, I may have been really railing against how terrible I thought this book was. And then my girlfriend starts reading it, and she's like, I love it. It's horrible, but I really love it, and I cannot get enough. So she's read all three of the books that are out right now.
Nice. Respectful.
And occasionally she's given me like a, this is ridiculous, I have to tell you about it. So that's what I was coming into with this, being like, I have my own initial reaction, but I also have really high praises from someone else whose opinion I value. Now, I will tell you this, when I asked her, hey, would you like to give any comments on the book and your thoughts on it? She looked at me and she sighed and she said, what is there to say? It's a garbage book for garbage people.
I'm garbage.
Well, so is she. My thoughts on this book, Duncan, is, yeah, you know, it did capture me. I don't think it's good. In fact, I think it's terrible. But I did enjoy myself a lot.
That's, I'm so glad we are very much on the same page. I think I'm feeling things a bit more strongly. And Jordy, I was very concerned what your approach would be to this, because for our consistent listeners, we covered The Bonesmith way back at the start of the year. It was a real cut off. Yeah. I would say that was proper kind of YA, everything you think of it. Go back to listen to the episode.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
In that episode, I come in and I go, it's very by the numbers for the genre, but you know what? It had a charm. It wasn't badly written. I found myself connecting to the main character. I enjoyed my time with it. And Geordie tore that book to shreds. You, sir, were like, it has nothing new to say. Art should push things forward. Why would you bother? You know, I don't think it's okay for this to just be okay. And I feel like you really hit it. So I'm interested to know why you maybe feel a bit differently about Fourth Wing. And if you want to make Bonesmith any apologies, you know, I'm sure he would appreciate it.
No. But so let's go through the book in terms of what it's about. And then we can talk about, you know, the things that work about it and the things that don't work about it. It takes us to a fantasy world, battles between dragon riders and griffin riders. You're at a very special school for special people, but it's a dangerous school. Oh no! Kind of in the same way as, like, A Deadly Education. The institution is so violent towards its people that it just doesn't care if they live or die, and they just have to kind of put up with that. Deadly Education had a lot of really good reasons for people to go to the extremely dangerous school, and this book does not. It is astoundingly stupid, some of the ways in which you're like, really, why don't you just have like a net at the bottom of this cliff? That just feels like it would save you so much effort.
This school is super dangerous. We constantly get reminded, you know, 50% of you are going to die. You know, only the strong survive here, because we're breeding the elite of the elite. You will be the warriors riding dragons and going into battle. And what makes this kind of different, though, is firstly, unlike in Deadly Education, where it's very clearly set up that, like, your odds of surviving outside the establishment are potentially worse than in it. So there's a motivator to go. The only reason these people are attending Killer Dragon School is because it's like a societal standing. You know, in this society, you go, you join the medics, or you join the scribes, or I presume you just be any other number of occupations that a society needs. You know, a baker, a farmer, a mason.
No, they don't exist.
They don't exist.
It's just like Divergent. There's only four jobs, and they are like cops, lawyer, farmer, and whatever the other, scientist, I think it was in Divergent. In this, it's, there are the quadrants, so there's only four. They are the medics, the scribes, the riders, and the infantry. So there are no normal jobs. There are no bureaucratic jobs. There are no like mundane support roles. They don't even have like military infrastructure. No one does any of that. It's just nerds, doctors, and two different types of soldiers.
I really just wanted one scene when they're going to get food at like the Dragon School canteen, and someone just ask the person serving them, like, what's your life? Where do you live? Do you stay in the academy, or do you go to your house at the end of the hill?
The dragon riders made it.
Oh yeah, you're right, they do, because she helps out. I'm so sorry. I'm critiquing world building. That's actually explained.
Who's growing it?
Yeah.
Is it the infantry? Are the infantry farming? And we're not being like facetious here, because genuinely, when people coming of age they literally get the choice of where do you go? And these are the only options. They don't have an option to be a farmer.
I was trying to think, like, is it just meant to be like, oh, these are all members of like high noble families? But that's clearly also not the case. I pieced that out. So you got this school, and it's like you're going to university. You got 3 years, and each year you're going to get deadlier and deadlier until you're the most elite fighting force in the world, and you go off riding your dragons to protect this nation. There are lands outside this nation, but we're not going to get to them yet. But this one nation is the only nation with dragons. They have magical wards that only dragon magic works, and everyone is highly indoctrinated to the one way of thinking. Key bit of history, though. In the past, there was a rebellion. A generation ago, to where our main characters are. It was crushed.
It was 5 years ago.
5 years ago. Gosh, it was only 5 years ago. Bloody hell.
It's only 5 years ago. Violet's 20 now, and she was 15 when it happened.
You're absolutely right, because her brother, yeah, fights in it. And all the kids of those that rebelled are branded and forced into Dragon Rider School as a means of controlling/punishing them.
And the plot of the story is that our main character, Violet, wants to be a scribe. She's always wanted to be a scribe, but her mother, who is like a commander, she's the leader of the school, she says, no, you're not going to be a scribe, which is what your dad wanted for you, your deceased father. You're going to be a dragon rider, like me. And I do not care if you live or die. And you're probably going to die because you're disabled.
Better to have her die with honour trying to become a dragon rider than dare she live as a scribe like her father. So the mother's a bit of a villain to the piece, if that wasn't obvious.
Yeah, for sure. Like many characters in this book, she is, like, unfathomably evil. I'm sure it gets revealed at a certain point in one of the subsequent books that she has good, if misguided, reasons for forcing her daughter into this, but as things stand, it's genuinely cartoonish the lack of, like, care or the way in which she does not appear as a human being. She's a plot device. And all of this exists much like in, say, this is the classic lock-in. Violet doesn't have a choice. She's compelled to go to badass school to learn to be a badass, and she has no way out of it. So even though she always wanted a quiet life, she's been compelled into action and adventure. Now, this is going to be kind of undermined by the rest of the book, and almost draw into question why it's framed like this at all in the first place, because it turns out not only is Violet extremely good at Dragon School, she actually really likes Dragon School, and she rejects and takes offence at every attempt to remove her from it.
Yes. Or we'll get into that. But, as you said, Violet starts off and she has to go to Dragon School. But to even get into Dragon School, you have to run the parapet.
So, the first thing that students do at the college is before they even start their lessons, before they get officially enrolled, they have to do an obstacle course. Not only is it, like, very dangerous and you can just fall. If you, like, trip, if you slip, or if, for example, it starts raining and there's nothing you can do, you just slip and die. 20% of applicants just die. And you almost think to yourself, that seems extremely redundant. Like, what if they fell and landed in a net and you just said, well, you didn't make it into Dragon School, but you didn't have to die because that's stupid.
Off to the infantry with you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what if, for example, there wasn't the quadrant had four parts and one of them was the armed forces and everyone wants to be a dragon rider, but if you don't succeed, you get sent to the infantry? And what if you said the infantry is basically a death trap? Going to the infantry is tantamount to suicide because it's like the Red Army in World War II and they're just going to human wave you at enemies who are surely going to kill you. So, genuinely, you have better odds of surviving if you do take on the extremely high challenge of being a dragon rider, because you get to be above the battle. Maybe that would make sense.
Another factor would just also to be show a level of social differentiation. I never got a strong vibe, other than obviously being a dragon rider is clearly cool, why you want to be a dragon rider, given the death rate is so high and no one gets to retire out of that role.
Yeah, they talk, because what you have at the start is the characters who want to be there view this as a great honour and a chance for ascension. But there's no indication about why they would enjoy the life. None of them have any actual enmity towards their nation's enemies, because the plot wouldn't work if they did. Like, if Violet had reasons to hate the Griffin Riders, then the book wouldn't work, because at the end, it's revealed, very not spoiler alert, she's working for the bad guys, and the Griffin Riders aren't enemies at all. They're just, like, suffering people.
I think let's kind of round out this conversation, though, about this school being so deadly and how it is and how it did constantly irks me, because I'm okay with there being certain gauntlets or a certain survival rate. In fact, something that I really enjoyed is the idea that the dragons, they play by their own rules. If they just decide to, on a whim, smoke a student, then guess what? They're too valuable. There's no recompense for that. That's just a hazard of working with dragons. That I could kind of vibe. When it's like, we're going to do first day of training on the training mats, and one kid just snaps another guy's neck, and they're like, oh, guess he's a murderer. That's where I was like, really?
They're not even in the school at this point. Jack is, it breaks a guy's neck before he's a student. They're on the parapet. And Jack literally doesn't even have a reason to do it. The idea, the philosophy behind it is, oh, if you die, it's because you're weak. So anyone who kills you is actually benefiting the army by, you know, getting you out of the way. Now, of course, that's a juvenile idea of how an army works. And it genuinely, not only is it, you know, stupid, it's contradicted by the novel itself. Because what we see as the book goes on is Violet cultivates around her a extremely loyal unit, a group of people who she can rely on, a group of friends, of comrades, and everything about the school is set up to disencourage that. They have team activities, but you're encouraged to undermine the people around you. All you're generating is at best, a unit-to-unit degree of adversity, which will completely undermine your work, because not if enough of your members of your squad die, they're going to just take people from other squads who were your enemies yesterday and put them in your team, and then you're expected to work with them, even though there's a good chance you've been trying to kill each other up to this point.
And it really boggles my mind that there's this idea that that doesn't leave school. This notion is like with a character like Jack, like, what, he's meant to go out there and not just on a whim start killing his own underlings. It's Darth Vader cartoonishly stupid and evil. And Darth Vader gets away with it because he is cartoonishly evil. This is meant to
But more specifically, he's unique within his armed forces. He's the only Jedi aside from Darth Sidious in the Empire, so they can't just replace Darth Vader. He does something no one else can do. You can replace all of these people because none of them are actually that special.
Completely right.
I will say this towards the positive point. The thing you talked about with, like, oh, if a dragon kills you, then, like, what are you going to do? We have no recourse. We can't control the dragons. They have their own society, their own civilization. And we respect them too much. We revere them. So if a dragon's going to do it, then what are you going to do? And yes, and from that point, I'm like, all right, so what I'm getting here is that the whole society goes by dragon rules. The idea is that, you know, they've incorporated this philosophy into their own society and into their own institutions because they revere dragons, and this is how the dragons behave. Obviously, it's still stupid because the humans often disagree with the dragons and think the dragons are making mistakes, so they don't follow them like gods. Their word isn't gospel, and it's contradicted by the narrative because teamwork and companionship is so important to the way in which the characters succeed, even though it's completely in defiance of what they've been taught to do.
The only way this kind of flies...
Let's talk about the characters.
Yeah, you're probably right. Violet. Or violence.
No, not violence. God. So what... I gotta say, Duncan, you talked about, like, eye-rolling moments in this book. Zayden's nickname for Violet being violence is so unbearably cringe.
When he first starts doing it, and it's kind of meant to, like, irk her, I thought, yes, that's a petty level of nickname shit, but that kind of flies with his cocky personality. When it meant to transition into more of a term of endearment is when it fell over.
Literally when she's, like, on the cusp of death at the end of the book, he uses that nickname, and I'm like, this is so completely the wrong time to use that. It takes me out of the emotions of the moment if you're doing this extremely stupid nickname. Like, what if your nickname was, like, I don't know, oh, this is my pal Big Dog. If someone was dying, you said, come on, Big Dog, wake up. You don't think that would take you out of the moment?
No, if anything, it would be more impactful to only in that moment when they're dying that you suddenly become real, you know. That's sort of what you're meant to do on that spin. You know, and it's also only Violet that has that nickname. It's not like they're all calling each other Maverick. And it doesn't quite fly. It wasn't a big bother for me. I thought it was intentionally juvenile at the start, and then the pivot to sincerity didn't land. But back to the point, Violet. I think Violet's got some interesting things going for her. Firstly, she has a disability. This is kind of put front and centre, the fact that she is kind of actually more fragile. She is weaker physically than the other people in this school. Geordie, how exactly did you kind of like interpret this? Is this meant to be like a particular real world condition?
Sort of. I've seen that Rebecca Yarros herself has some similar disability, but it's inspired by something from her real life. And my interpretation of this was it was like hypermobility. It's basically that her joints are very weak. They can pop easily. She's also more flexible, so she has like overextending joints, so she can like pull her arm back really far, for example, but if she does it too far, it will just pop out of the socket. She's also just small. Like, I don't think a height is officially given. Zayden's height is given as 6'4", except it's put in really weird phrases where I think it said, like, he must be over 6 foot and 4 inches beyond that. And I'm like, yeah, you probably could have phrased that slightly more elegantly, but... And she comes up to his, like, chest. So it's like, okay, I can hold up my hand where I think that is.
Yeah, the chest of a 6'4" person, you're still only, like, you're, like, 5'7", aren't you? Like, you're still tall.
Genuine, that's a good point. I was interpreting her as, like, 5'2". But maybe you're right. She's just a bit smaller than everyone else. And everyone else is, like, really big and powerful because it's a selective military organization. And everyone else got weeded out.
I'm 5'11", and I have a partner who's 5'1", 5'2", and like I can rest my chin on like the top of her head. So if I had an additional 5 inches, she could have an additional 5 inches and come up to the same place. So she could definitely be like 5'6", 5'7".
Did a quick Google. I saw someone calculate on TikTok based off of Zayden's height. She's 5'2".
Well. That's my estimates out the window. Sorry for wasting your time, people.
Yeah, and another comment here, which has now been deleted, says, the book says she's 5 foot nothing.
Okay, fine. She's short.
But I would only say that she's described as being small, but the phrase in which is used, and it's a very deliberate word that's being used because it makes me laugh, is petite. A character who refers to her height insultingly refers to her as petite. Which is really funny, because it's like if someone was trying to call me chunky and said, oh, Geordie, you're just a bit too powerful. I'm like, wow, that's actually the most positive spin you could have put in it.
It really does. It's like, oh, so she's delicate and dainty.
What I'm getting across, Duncan, is that in every single way, Violet is almost an ubermensch. Put aside the fact that she's, like, physically small for a dragon rider, and obviously has this disability, which hinders her ability to ride dragons and fight people, and then get past that, and you're like, oh, but by the end of the book, she can ride dragons extremely well, in fact, better than most people, and at first, the book is going into all the ways in which she has to cheat in order to fight people by poisoning them. But then by the end of the book, she is a significantly better hand-to-hand combatant than almost everyone around her. And you think, wait, I thought this was supposed to be like disability representation. And it really feels more like disability porn, because she's not actually being held back by her disability. In fact, it barely seems to be a factor anymore, except by lip service.
I mean, I am inclined to agree. But it does work quite nicely, I think, early on. I genuinely did enjoy in this book, going on to the positive side, instances where Violet is shown to outthink her combatants and outthink her approach to some of the tasks. The big one you referenced earlier is she's got to get on the mat and like wrestle people, engage in hand-to-hand combat.
Mm-hmm.
And what she does is she works out the roster, figures out who she's going to be fighting, volunteers in the kitchen, and basically mildly poisons them before each match. And this is how she keeps going.
On one hand, you're like, oh, that's kind of clever. And it's the sort of thing which you think about for another 2 seconds. You go, wait, that's extremely stupid, because how does she know who she's feeding? It's not like a restaurant. The food doesn't get brought to your table. You get served. It's like a school dinner. That explicitly happens in a scene in the latter part of the book. So how does she know how to poison them?
It does imply a sleight of hand. Like, she's subtly putting it, you know, on top of the eggs as they get ladled.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a classic case. It was cool, and then you started thinking too much. I really enjoyed another instance, though, where they have to do this. They have to face like a gauntlet, climbing up a cliff face. And Violet kind of makes out, oh my goodness, there's this chimney section. We have to push your back up against one side of the wall and walk your way up. And she's just too short. It's been designed to limit people under a certain height, which, I'm not going to lie, does feel like, hang on, you should just have a little thing before they even get on the parapet. You must be this tall to climb. Like, she thinks of a way around it, but I'm like, what are all the teachers doing? Just like, yep, we made that chimney, and it only works if you're 5'8 or over. We don't tell people this until they're on their going to die run.
But maybe there's a reason that's buried late in the series, like the people who die at the school are like fueling some magic or something. That could be a good explanation as to why they're like really willingly throwing people's lives away. And you could even have it then like have something to say about the world. Like Deadly Education is like, yeah, we're feeding poor kids to monsters so that the rich kids make it through okay. That's a theme. It isn't obvious yet. Outside of, you know, authoritarianism bad, what sort of wider point is being made through these deaths?
My only kind of theory is that it's designed to basically mentally scar the people who come through. Like, so that the people that come out the other end are completely desensitized to the death of their comrades. Which I would believe if we didn't meet Violet's sister, who still seems fairly well adjusted.
Yeah, that's, again, another contradiction, which is that the only exposure we have to genuine dragon riders is they're just like the students, even down to making juvenile jokes in, like, a strategy meeting.
But back to Violet, back to this scene. She's too short for it, so she has to think about it. And the first one is that they're, like, safety ropes. Well, you know, closest thing they've got to it. And she uses one of these to help her make this climb. And then later on, you've got to do this kind of dead run up a wall. And you're not meant to bring any equipment. But, oh, there's a loophole in the rules. And she uses one of her daggers to help her pull herself up. And I'm like, brilliant. There's a physical challenge. And the main character is going to think of a clever, outside-the-rules way, lateral thinking to get around it. That's why I watch Taskmaster on Channel 4. Go check it out. Great TV show.
I really hate to be a negative Nancy because, in principle, yes, I like the idea of someone who is physically limited having to think their way around challenges. And occasionally I did like that in this book, but you have picked out the two examples I really didn't like. Like that Violet can just keep figuring out who she's going to fight, poison them and only them, and never have anyone realize that this is happening or call her out on it. The only people who figure it out are the people who don't want to call her out on it. And she solves this problem at the end with this gauntlet, but using a rule which we're never told about. We only get told about why she wasn't allowed to do it after she's already done it, and she's provided an explanation about this loophole.
It doesn't really take you, the reader, along for the ride. There's one other kind of instance of this, which again, I was like, oh, that seems really neat. And then again, the thought process, and that is Violet riding her dragon. So
yeah,
Violet's the first person to come up, or she's very insulted by this originally, but who gets a saddle so she doesn't have to grip with her knees or her thighs.
Everyone else who's a dragon rider, grips one horn on their dragon and just holds on with their knees, and Zayden makes her a saddle. Her love interest makes her a saddle for later in the book and attaches it to his dragon. And she's the only person in the entire history of the Dragon Riders Corps who has used a saddle.
This really frustrated me, because the whole logic of, oh, well, you're weak if you don't have the thigh strength. And I was just like, people, you're meant to be doing, like, aero maneuvers. Do you know the G-force you have to be putting? No one, no human, unless these people are not human, has the thigh strength to take multiple G and hold on. Also, another key detail, what happens if you pass out? You just die?
Yep.
Like, what are you useless waste? The only thing I was kind of like, well, maybe all the other dragons are just assholes and are like, no. I'm not having a saddle put on me. This is not okay.
I think that is genuinely the canon reason, is that every other dragon is an asshole, except for the extremely special dragons which Violet gets. So, I hate to use this word because it is so coded with misogyny, but it really does apply to this book, possibly more than any other in history, and that is Mary Sue.
Oh, Geordie, don't wash your mouth out. So, Mary Sue, for those who don't know, it's the idea of a character, and a female character in this particular instance, to be very precise about it, who is just kind of good at everything. They face no real challenges.
It's highly associated with fan fiction, where people will write self-insert characters into a pre-existing story, and all of the other characters cannot help but be amazed by how skilled or powerful or clever or beautiful they are. And if you go down the list, Violet really does hit all of these. Even with the, like, detracting factor of she has a physical disability, and that holds her back from being as physically able as her colleagues, it, as we've already established, it doesn't hold her back in any actual way. All it does is it provides her more ways in which to demonstrate her superiority by outthinking the system and the people around her. And then subsequently, she's genuinely just better than everyone at fighting anyway. So why would she need help? You know, during her selection to get a dragon, she fights off three armed people at the same time. So Violet, at her absolute worst, and with like a broken ankle in that scene actually, is defeating or going head to head with three people at once. A subsequent scene where she is overpowered but has managed to successfully fight for her life enough to defend herself, she's fighting seven people.
This really, what really gets my goat up about this is not so much about Violet being kind of overpowered, because guess what? I love an overpowered character. Give me my Conan, give me my King Cole. They can go into a room and smash them all to bits. That, I am down for that, and I do enjoy reading about that. What gets me about Violet is that no one seems to ever notice. Everyone's always like, you're the weakest, you're the runt, everyone's thinking it. And I'm like, people, are we looking at the same character? Like, we have all seen her completely kick ass, and just because she's 5 inches shorter than the rest of you, you never seem to take this into account.
And the opposite is also true, because her best friend Rhiannon, at a certain point, you know, Violet says Zayden is like the most powerful dragon rider of his generation. And then Rhiannon says, well, so far. So at first, this is like quite well put. Violet doesn't really understand what Rhiannon means. You, the reader, do, because, you know, it's laid out in pretty explicit language. Rhiannon believes in Violet. She believes that after everything she's demonstrated so far, she's going to triumph and prove everyone wrong and prove that she's not only a great dragon rider, but she's the best one. And then half a chapter later, she explicitly tells Violet this in plain language. And you go, oh my God, how can you just not... How can you be so unsubtle?
And also, there's something really different. And this, I don't know why I kind of... I feel this push and shove sometimes. Because obviously, We want to follow the underdog. I want to root for the underdog. That's something quite intrinsic in my enjoyment of media and the world, to be honest. And the thing is, though, you can still root for them if they just stay in the game. Like, imagine, have you ever seen the film Eddie the Eagle, based on the real life bloke?
I haven't actually, but I kind of know what you mean.
Olympic ski jumper. But I'm going to talk about the film, because I wasn't alive when it happened. But in that film, the whole point is that he wants to be an Olympic ski jumper, and he's not very good. And, like, his big accomplishment, his big, like, punch-the-air moment, isn't that he goes to win gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
It's that he simply qualifies. It's that no one thought he could do anything, but he proved he was good enough to be there.
The end of Rocky 1 is Rocky goes all 12 rounds. He doesn't win. He goes the distance. He makes it through to the end. And he proves that he had what it took to be a contender. Like, that's way more satisfying than him pulling off the miraculous win. Because you feel how hard he had to fight just to get this, of all things. The real issue is that she's not the underdog. She obviously isn't the underdog, right? She comes from a family of extremely powerful dragon riders. Everyone keeps talking about how her brother Brennan was the greatest, and then he died tragically, and now she has big shoes to fill. And her sister is an amazing dragon rider who has a unique special power, which is like essential to the war effort. And her mother is an extremely important dragon rider with an amazing magical ability. So she already comes from a legacy. She has like high expectations. She's held in high regard by everyone right from the start. And then everything that should be a penalty isn't a penalty. She's textually spoken about by characters who have access to her brain through psychic powers to be the smartest person in the school. And then everything that she does turns to gold because she's so special. She's so blessed. Like, when it's time for her to pick a dragon, they introduce the largest, most dangerous, powerful dragon who hasn't bonded to anyone in decades after his last rider died. So don't expect anyone to try and bond with him. It's not going to happen.
Oh, but Violet is just too good. She stands up for a little dragon, mm-hmm. who people are planning to kill, by the way, because it's a hatchling, and obviously Oh, fair enough. But, like, we have to kill the runt of the dragons. Insanity. And then that proves herself to the greatest dragon of all time. So she gets picked. Okay, can I throw up some other dragon material? We mentioned Pern at the start. I don't want to draw every comparison back to it because I'll do that enough during the sex scenes. My other dragon-based material, though, that I was thinking about is actually How to Train Your Dragon. Not the film, the books. And what's kind of cool in those books, our main character genuinely has a crap dragon.
Yes.
He's...
Toothless suck.
He is the underdog of the dragon society, and thus he bonds with also the underdog of the dragon society.
So I had already been spoiled that she had two dragons, but I wasn't sure how that was going to happen. I figured they would happen on like different occasions. So when the like little golden one is introduced, you're like, oh, that makes sense. It's a dragon that is like physically appropriate to her. Like, she's the only dragon rider small enough for this dragon to be able to carry. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, cool. And then it inverted my expectations by having her defend this other dragon. And then the largest and most powerful dragon steps in, saves her, and then claims her as his rider. And you go, okay, so it's like an irony thing. She's the smallest, but she gets the most powerful and largest one. Okay, that feels a little silly, but whatever. But it goes so far beyond that. Because that, having the best and most powerful, century-old, wise warrior dragon, that's not unique enough.
No.
She gets two dragons. And this is textually, this has never happened in history before. No one has ever bonded with two dragons before.
I know, and all the humans are like, we need to check if this is with the rules. Maybe she can renounce one of the dragons. No, you simply can't do this. To be fair, I genuinely did like the scenes where the humans are all having their like, oh no, we're not sure we can allow this. And she talks to her dragon. Her dragon's just like, we asked dragons don't give a damn what these generals are chatting about. You've bonded. Congrats.
It's genuinely, that's the one that's almost farcical, you know, where it's like, fair enough, you want to have an intelligent character. Okay, fine, she's smart of everyone around her. That's her main strength. Cool. Oh, she's actually pretty good at fighting people. Well, fine, heroes and stories are good at fighting people. That makes sense. It means they can go on their adventures. But when she gets, she's the first person in history to have ever bonded with two dragons. That's how important and special she has to be. It feels embarrassing. You know, it feels juvenile.
What feels funny is that people continue to think that she's somehow the lesser person, and everyone's still looking down her noses at her. And I'm like, it's like only the outcasts really band around her. And I'm like, guys, at this point, I mean, it does a little bit. To be fair, they do address that, like, she gets a nicer table at lunch and people do start brown nosing a little bit. But if this is the first time in ever, I would feel like, wouldn't, like, the teachers just be like, okay, she's now getting private lessons. We need to study. What has just happened? And can we repeat it, please? I don't know.
Well, she does start getting private lessons, Duncan. That does happen after she demonstrates her next amazingly superior quality, which is that when her magical powers finally manifest, she has the rarest magic type possible. She's a lightning user. She calls them bolts of lightning. And they say, this hasn't manifested in over a century. It's so incredibly rare. And I was like, come on. She can't have both, like, a paired bond of dragons, who have, which has never happened before in history, and have the largest and most powerful, okay, second largest and most powerful dragon of its generation, because the main general of the army does have a bigger and stronger one, and a superbly powerful magical ability, which is explicitly by the text, yes, the power is generated by the dragons, but the magic is relevant only to her. It comes from her, not her dragons. It's just, it's so, it's crazy. You can't expect people to just buy this, right?
It was when we were getting to the end, I was genuinely starting to believe, and this is my, I haven't read the other books, that, like, there's going to be some reveal that her dad, you know, someone did some secret incantations on her as, like, a baby to, like, manifest her as being the most elite magical special person. You know, she is the child of destiny, and that is why it will all be for her. And again, we're reading a book. Obviously, you want to follow. The protagonist is special. This isn't new. This isn't something worth critiquing.
Right. What I think, why is the book about this person? Because they're the person who is special enough that the book has to be about them, right?
Yes. Not an unreasonable
thing.
But this
is pushing it.
Yes, it's the way it's presented and the fact that we get these sort of repeating, oh my gosh, for the first time in a millennia. And then you get about 5 chapters later and it goes, oh my gosh, for the first time in 100 years this has happened. And you're like, okay, definitely seen this before. But Violet isn't just special in all those ways though, Geordie. And I do want to just take us on to the next bit of why she's a bit special.
Okay.
Because Violet gets the hottest man at school.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And we haven't talked about him much, but Violet's in a love triangle. And this...
Not really.
Oh, this gets spicy. So why don't you introduce her primary lover for the book?
Zayden Ryerson. First of all, his name is stupid. I don't have anything else to say about it. I just don't like that he's called Zayden. It feels wrong. So... Zayden is the hero of a different book. If you really were like, okay, I need a sort of edgy Gary Stu character to be the leader of my dragon riding rebellion story instead of my dragon riding going to special school story, this would be your main guy. And unfortunately, as we learn from the last chapter, he's now a perspective character, and he's going to be a perspective character in the subsequent books, which is agonizing, because I really hated Zayden's one chapter in this book. I was awful.
Just a really small thing, because we the whole book's done exclusively from Violet's perspective. When we had that Zayden chapter at the very end, I genuinely was having trouble with pronouns. Because I was so used to Violet and her voice, he would when he'd be like, "Ah, yeah. Oh, she's awake," I'd be like, "Wait, who's she again? Oh, Violet. Yeah, sorry. I know where I am now."
Zayden is the child of the revolution's leader. He was spared from execution, like his parents, because one, he wasn't technically like involved; he was just a witness to it. But also because he takes on this debt to like the government by bearing this like the lives and souls of all the other children of the rebellion leaders, and they all have to become dragon riders, and he has ritualistic scars on his back, each one representing one of 107 rebellion leaders' children on his back, and he's like the most hated person by the people in power, but they need him alive because he's just so damn good at riding dragons.
Yep.
Also, he's really, really hot.
How is he hot? Describe to me, what makes him just so hot?
In the chapter where he like takes off his shirt and everyone in the gym is genuinely drooling over how hot he is as he wrestles, he's described as in ways in which he's so muscular but so lean that I'm like, this sounds like he is genuinely anorexic. This can't be healthy.
Oh, it's the dream though. It's the ideal.
He's never lost a fight. He's the best sword fighter, he's the best wrestler, he has a incredibly powerful magical gift, just like her. He can control shadows, because he's dark and brooding and edgy, and they're shadows, like Naruto-style shadows. They can pick things up and throw things and cover things up.
But you didn't also mention his charming personality. Don't you know that he's like I said, he's bearing the responsibility for all the other rebel children. So he's both like really dark and brooding, but also like a bit of a big brother figure to all of them.
Yes.
And he will always be happy to be like really serious when he's in his commanding roles, because he's like the wing commander, by the way. You got this rebel kid, you make him give him every reason to hate it, to hate you. And then you go, right, he's too powerful. Let's give him all the power, put everyone under his command. There we go, guys. Top plan.
Yep, that's it. That's what we got to do. Make it so that he has a good reason to be in contact with everyone in the organization. You know, you want to stop him from fermenting dissent. So make sure that he has a lot of power, authority, and reason to talk to everybody. There's a bit, this is genuinely the stupidest thing in the entire book by far. So all of the, we mentioned that he has a sizzling physique and his like ritual scars. We haven't mentioned that he's covered in cool black magical tattoos. And some of these magical tattoos are used to track his location because he's so suspicious. But the magical tattoos, which all of the rebel children have been given, don't work if three or more of them are together at once.
And I'll remind you, everyone, they've all been sent to the same academy and are all under.
They're not even allowed to leave the academy. They have to be here.
So I suppose the logic is that you know they're all in the academy because you can't track one of them. So if one dashes on their own, you can pick them up. But what if, like, three of them make a break for it on their own?
Yeah. I think it's even stupider than that, because here's the deal. Who cares if they're by themselves, you know? Like, let's say one of them flies off. Well, it doesn't matter, because you still have all of the other Dragon Riders under your control. So if you were like, if anyone leaves, we'll execute everyone else, then you just execute everyone else. Like, not all of them are there yet, because some of them are children who aren't at the academy yet. So if you're like, oh, if any of you runs off AWOL, we'll just kill the hostages. Okay, well, you already have that power. Why would the you have your choice to put magical tattoos on these people for the purpose of tracking them. But obviously there are limitations, right? Mm. It's not a coincidence that you get enough of them together and it doesn't work. Clearly, that's a limitation of the magic you've used to put the tattoo on. So why not have it so they only work if three or more of them are together, right? Or if two of them are together, then it sets off a little ping. Because you can only... Because a conspiracy requires communication to multiple parties. That's what conspiracy means under the law. It's agreeing as a group to do something. So why would you fail to track them at the only time then able to conspire?
There's also a point made about, like, it's against the rules for them to gather. So Violet sees them gathering very early in the book, and it's like, oh, I should report this, but she, you know, she feels sorry for them, has a chat with Zayden, and they're like, oh, I'll keep your secret. But then I just went, but, like, they've got to function. How do you make sure, like, what's a gathering? What if they just want to do a study group in someone's bedroom? Or, anyway, let's get back to Zayden.
I mean, I gotta be really explicit about this. Liam and Imogen have, like, breakfast together a lot. They're both rebellion kids. I didn't do a head count, but I'm pretty sure Zayden is occasionally at that table. Wait, no, he is at that table. So, they're having breakfast together. But that's not setting off alarm bells. That's not, like, illegal. So, they're allowed to work together. Because, like... Of course, it's insane to be like, yeah, we can't have any of you assemble, but we're putting you all in the same organization and telling you to work together.
So, and also this is never addressed. It's never like four of them want to get together and they go, gosh, we need to invite a non-marked person to come along so it's allowed. Anyway, back to Zayden. So Zayden, let's talk about Zayden's personality and his relationship with Violet. So he's the love interest, and key details... He's got the dragon who is currently banging Violet's dragon. Or, no, Violet's dragon is banging his dragon. They're a couple. Let's not go into the dragony details.
Yeah, they're a mated pair. And dragons mate for life.
How lovely. Now, Violet's relationship with Zayden starts out with hatred. Because his father killed her brother. And her mother executed his father. And you're like, okay... Cool, I get you, you're on opposite sides. But at the same time, she thinks he's really hot. Like, cannot stop thinking this. And they have a little kind of understanding.
Violet is one of the horniest characters in fiction, I think.
She completely outstrips any sword and sorcery hero I've ever read about.
Conan is positively chaste compared to Violet at certain points in his book.
Violet is constantly thinking about him, thinking of wanting to be with him. And even when she's like, I think he wants to kill me, or I'm scared of him. By the way, he's like her wing commander. He's like in charge of her throughout their kind of like school, I don't know, like houses, I guess, would be one way to describe it.
Zayden and Violet have a enemies to lovers relationship. They start off with every reason to hate each other, but actually they both have the hots for each other right from the start. And then when their dragons, when Tern, her dragon, picks her, it brings her into this dragon polycule because she and Zayden now stuck together. They're not allowed to separate the dragons who are a mated pair. They actually can't even be apart for more than a couple of days without missing each other. And because the dragons have their say-so, that means that Zayden and Violet are locked in together. And... like much like in the Eragon books, the bond between dragon and rider is so strong that if the dragon dies, so too does the rider, and vice versa. And that means that if Violet dies, Tern might die, which means the dragon that Zayden's dragon called Sirena, something like that. Then she'll die, and that means Zayden will die. So if anything bad happens to Violet, it will lead to a domino effect that will see everyone die, which means that the stakes are so high it can literally never happen in the books. Tern can never die in these books. Sirena can never die in these books because the stakes would be too disastrously high and it would never be allowed to happen. But the point is, they're locked together now. That even though they hate each other textually, now they're stuck together.
And now Zayden has an active interest in helping Violet succeed at school and not die. Because obviously, if Violet died through any of the random bits of training that she does, this organisation would lose not just their up-and-coming most powerful rider, but one of their current most powerful riders. So they do nothing about that as an organisation.
It didn't even occur to me that the school should be like, oh fuck, we really need Tan. We better stop making Violet do really dangerous training exercises that probably should just have a safety net at the bottom.
So they got the hots and they're going to keep getting closer and closer. It first off, it's a short moment. And then one night, the dragons are banging. And that means that Violet is filled with horniness. She goes running off into the night, bumps into Zayden, and they have their first like passionate kiss. But he's like, no, I cannot. It would be inappropriate. I'm like your commander and you just want to bang me because you've got psychic dragon horniness right now. Alas, we shall wait and until we really want each other later. Fine. That's going to happen.
Right. So here's the funny thing is that you very relevantly brought up the Dragon Riders of Pern and about how that scene is like full of like in that book, which is like dubiously consensual, is full of like intense passion. And this moment too is full of intense passion. It's described extremely vividly and explicitly about how amazing and sensual and heated this moment between them is as they have their first kiss. And what we learn about Zayden and this and all subsequent romantic and sexual scenes is that no one has ever cared more about consent than Zayden Ryzen.
I actually have a lot of respect for this in the character. This guy has morals. I kind of liked him. It made me get slightly hot under the collar for him even more. Well done, Zayden.
He's constantly, like, in the sex scene, almost every other line is like, have you thought this through? And are you sure you want this? It genuinely is like, wow, this is like being back in the first year of university.
Like I said, it's actually really cool to see a character who, you know, has this in the forefront of their mind. It's actually really good to see this almost as a complete flip of that scene we discussed so much in Dragon Riders of Pern. I think the only thing where it does come a little bit ridiculous is there are multiple scenes where Violet is effectively just stripping naked and jumping on top of him, and he's still concerned whether or not she's interested.
Yep.
But
yes, it works. It's funny, but it works.
To get to the point, I've not even brought up I mentioned it was a love triangle. There's this other bloke. He's called, like, Dane. He's annoying. I don't like him. You're not meant to like him.
Yes.
But I'm not going to lie. I knew not to like him before we even got past, like, sentence three. This book's very good at telling you where the punches are coming from. And when I mean very good, I mean bad at hiding anything. Incredibly predictable.
It felt like she was told at the start of, before she wrote this book, like, this book has to have a love triangle. And she's like, I don't really want there to be a love triangle. That feels like kind of redundant at this point. I really do know who the main love interest is going to be. And they're like, but it says on the wall, it has to have a love triangle. And so she gave a heavy sigh and was like, okay, fine. There's a extremely handsome boy next door who loves rules, unlike the rebel, and has blonde hair instead of dark hair, and is very strong and tall and handsome, but not as strong nor as tall nor as handsome as the main love interest. And he loves rules so much that it genuinely feels like he might be an android.
Oh, and don't also get the biggest difference. As we joke, Zayden is always checking in on the consent in their physical relationship. This guy, He does not ask for consent before he uses his mind-reading magic. Very clear, he's the bad one, Zayden's the good one.
That's the key differential, is Zayden's allowed to be dark and brooding and even violent at times, but in every way that matters, he cares about Violet. He actually cares about Violet's safety, because when it matters, he checks in. But in every other occasion, he leaves it up to Violet to figure things out by herself. He gives her a hint about how to solve the gauntlet. He doesn't tell her how to do it. He sends, like, someone to act as her bodyguard, but he doesn't follow her around himself. And he makes sure that Liam, her bodyguard, who is the most fated for death character possibly ever, not since the birth of Jesus Christ has anyone been more doomed by prophecy than Liam.
So, this is the love triangle, and Dane, he's not even a contender. It's basically Violet never fancies Dane in any level. She never makes a decision between them.
But no, Dane, no. At the start of the book, it's like, oh, it's Dane, who I always had a crush on growing up. And at the, like, maybe in chapter 1 and 2, it's like, okay, there's going to be a rival between Dane and the bad boy. By the time you get to chapter 3... Dane is so unbelievably claustrophobic and insufferable that every time he appears in a book, you're like, oh, just go away. What are you doing here? And a lot of the scenes with him were really samey, which was another problem.
This is a big issue in this book, and I think I'm glad you got to this, because really, there's only a couple key things I really want to hit on the head in this novel. I think there is maybe only 4 left. Through Dane, we can explore the sameness, and then we'll go jump back over to Zayden to explore the sexiness. But sameness first. This book really felt like, to me, it was missing 3 more drafts, a couple more edits.
Yes, like, absolutely.
I don't want to say that this, while we've joked about like some of the writing issues, moment to moment, the descriptions, the characters, I don't think they were terrible. You know, some of the dialogue...
No, I agree. It's functional.
Was genuinely... And it borderline did... Sometimes... A lot of the time it was cringy. But it got a witty bit in here and there. Like...
Yeah,
it
I
was
agree.
Working. The problem with this book is there was seen to be quite a lot of instances where we have... A new challenge is referenced at the end of a chapter. Well, guys, we've got the gauntlet coming up next month. New chapter. It's time for gauntlet. Violet is physically unable to do it. Dane tells her that she shouldn't be here and he can get her out to be a scribe. Violet wants to stay. Zayden drops a hint. Violet does a thing, clever thing, to get over the challenge. The dickhead students still think she's weak. Dane thinks she maybe twisted the rules, and Zayden gives her a cheeky little smile and a wink. And this plays out.
Yeah.
I shit you not. I worked it. I had it down to about 5 times in this book. From
That's,
on the... Probably underestimating it. Between the mat, between the gauntlet, between threshing, between the war games, and... Oh, you're right, and the... No, you're right. No, and this is the one where they steal the map. Whatever that was called.
Yeah, that too.
That too.
Wow.
Yeah.
This really surprised me, Duncan.
So formulaic.
No, you're right. That you've made a really good point about it being formulaic. But actually, the thing I was going to say, the thing that really makes this book work, the reason why it's engaging and sharp throughout, is that it has these like mini sections where the overall challenge of the book is just survive, right? Got to make it through school to be a dragon rider. And you go, okay, well, that's a really, really long-term goal, and it's hard to actually demonstrate forward progress if the only rule is survive. So Rebecca Yarros does something quite clever by adding in these mini-arcs, these little triumphs you can accomplish along the way, ticking things off almost like a video game. And I thought that this was, like, really good and gave the book a lot of forward momentum. But you have genuinely made a really good point, because it hadn't really occurred to me that they are so formulaic and they all follow the same structure, even down to almost all of them ending with a revelation about how cool and skilled Violet is at something else.
And I don't like to undermine what you felt, because I felt that too. It did actually give a lot of momentum, because I read this book, Jordy. I think I said to you previously... I read like the first half in like a single sitting, because each section had a great sense of, well, I'll just get to the end of this bit. Well, I'll just get through the war games. I'll just get through threshing.
You really need Duncan to say almost word for word what you told me before Dungeons & Dragons last week, because I found it so shocking and incredible.
I started reading this book at about 9:30 on the first night. And I, like I said at the start of this episode, I read those first opening chapters and I went, gosh, what has Georgie picked for me? This is going to be agonising. And so I kept reading a little bit, and then I closed the book. It was 2:30 in the morning, and I'd read half. And it was the most biggest realisation, though. And this I really want to come back to, because this has been a real nitpicky episode. But this book,
yes, it has
a sense of momentum. It has, it's a page turner. It's not too challenging, you know. Mm-hmm. It's easy flying, and that's fun. That's, it's digestible. It's,
yes,
speaks. And like I said, emotionally, I feel like I'm really kind of punching out here. Like, yeah, screw you, Dane. And I'm like, well, to an extent, I was meant to feel that, because that's what Violet feels.
Yes, absolutely.
So I am engaging with the characters on a proper emotional level. Zayden, we said, he's nearly cringe. Oh, there's just something, you kind of, you like the bloke. You sort of kind of get taken away with it. And there's a certain aspect here where, sorry, I'm going off a tangent again, Geordie, so I'll just hit this point.
No, please, go.
Where this book did actually a really good job talking about the writing, you know, world building, maybe not the strong point. Dialogue, not even always amazing, but there's something about how,
no, definitely not,
the characters' emotions are written that you really feel invested in how Violet is feeling. I felt for Violet, I felt with Violet. The descriptions of like her anger or her frustration really came across to, mm-hmm, me as a reader, and definitely,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, she ain't a plank of wood. She's not complex, but she's got something.
It's engaging. It's fine. It's fun. And the book goes by pretty fast. It's long, like really long, considering what it's about. But it's always pretty enjoyable, even when you're thinking something's kind of stupid. You're like, it's not stupid in an offensive way. It's stupid in a, oh, come on. There is a lack of economy to the writing, which I feel is, should be pointed out. This stood out to me as someone who enjoys writing as a almost an embarrassing failure of economy of words, where right as Violet and Zayden are about to have sex, the emotions of the scene are incredibly high, and the passion is so vivid and pungent in the scene, and Violet says, I'm on the, like, essentially she says, like, I'm on the birth control herb, you know, like the magical herb we have in this world. And then the narration takes over and it says, now, it said, of course we both were. Basically everyone at the school is, because no one wants a bunch of little dragon riders running around. So this line, this combination of two lines is very important, because what are we learning about it? One, we know that Violet is like prepared and sexually confident enough to have this conversation with her partner. Okay, we've learned something about Violet. She's prepared for what's going to happen and she's not concerned about the consequences because she's made preparation. We've learned something about world building. There's a like drug out there which works for both men and women, and it's commonplace throughout the writers. And also, it's so ubiquitous at the school that she almost didn't need to say anything because it is so ubiquitous. And then the follow-up line from Zayden is, same. We didn't need Zayden to say that, actually, because we already learnt that he probably already is on it. She's already said, about as explicit as she can, that he can fill her up like a chocolate eclair. And that line is so, it's so blunt and just falls like a dead fish at your feet in its like blankness and its uninterestingness and its irrelevance to the information that's been added to the scene and to the like momentum going forward, because it's not sexy, it's not functional, it doesn't tell us any new information. It's just bad writing, and I bring it up because it made me laugh about how bad that one little exchange is. But it also speaks to a lot of other clunky writing elements.
Yeah, it's a pretty solid example. And that's why I said it's not egregious. It's something that you look at and you think, oh, you just needed, your editor should have just come in with a bit of pixie dust and just picked up a lot of these. You know, I'm not annoyed that an author pops that in on their first go through a scene. I'm annoyed that it stays in there once you stop and go back and proofread it.
Book editing is not what it used to be, Duncan, and it's not like a... That's just something we should bear in mind about future books, you know? Editing teams are smaller than they've ever been, and they're only going to get shorter, because as AI infiltrates the publishing industry, they're going to say, like, oh, well, we don't really need as big an editorial team now that we have large language models which can review books for mistakes like this and make recommendations. So things like this are genuinely just going to get worse. And having spoken to Lauren about the next two books in this series, they are definitely worse in this particular regard. They're worse written sentence to sentence, probably because those books do not have as many drafts as this one did, because this book was such a smash hit that they went, we need to get more of them now.
I feared for that, and it is a common complaint that I've had about long-running series. I don't think you share this, but if you're going to do a book series, I really appreciate it when you kind of keep them all roughly the same chunkiness. It really does bother me when book series, they get fatter and fatter and fatter if they go on. See Harry Potter, see A Song of Ice and Fire. And it probably irks me more than it should, but, you know, I'd like to know what I'm going in for. That's why I'm not going to like Expanse. Oh, Chef's Kiss, you know?
Mm.
They have, you know what you're getting with an Expanse book. And I think that needs to be praised more. So, let's get back in, because I think there's only a few short things to really mention here. And we've kind of touched on both of them. The sex in this book is really explicit. And when I mean really explicit,
yeah.
I mean things you... thrusting in and out. Like...
labial walls are being pushed apart all over the place here.
Yes. This is no, there is, this is not just like a Fate of Black. This makes A Court of Thorns and Roses seem practically chase. This is so far, far beyond what would have been seen in Twilight. I'm glad you actually differentiate it as NA, because I think it is so explicit here. I feel like there needs to be a level of like parental awareness if you want to hand this book, you know, a fun fantasy series about dragon riders. There should be a level of, oh, actually... don't give it to your youngest child.
That's a good point. There aren't any, like, parental warnings in this book, are there?
I wasn't aware, no. There's a really weird thing in books.
Hang on, that's a blah, 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 blah. Well, it does, yeah. Fourth Wing is a non-stop-filling adventure fantasy set in a brutal and competitive world of military college for dragon riders, which contains elements regarding war, battle, hand-to-hand combat, perilous situations, blood, intense violence, brutal injuries, death, poisoning, graphic language, and sexual activities that are shown on the page. I will say only that it doesn't use the word explicit for the sexual stuff. This is not me being prudish. I genuinely think that is useful for readers to know that, because you deserve to have a sample or a good sense of what you're getting. Because that warning really highlighted the violence in the book. And yeah, this is quite a violent book. There are a lot of injuries and deaths in it, but they're nowhere near as explicit for the most part compared to the sexual stuff. And I feel like the word explicit is kind of missing from that, because there are books that contain sex which are not, you know, describing breaking every item of furniture in the room by how hot and passionate their sex is, describing the different positions, describing the walls of your vagina being parted by his thick girthy penis.
Geordie, I'm not going to lie to you, I actually feel inclined to sort of bring us towards a close here, because there are so many other aspects I could talk about this book. We don't really talked about the climax, we don't really talked about the final twist, but you know what? I don't think I need to. I feel like I've put out a flavour of this book, and it can kind of take it, like, if you're interested in this, read it and get those bits for yourself. Like, it didn't change my opinion on anything more so than what I've said already.
I'm inclined to agree. I don't have too much to say. I will only say this in regards to the end, because there are two twists at the end of this book. One of them is so obvious throughout the book that it barely even qualifies as a twist. Turns out, hey, guess what? Zayden is a bad guy. Oh, wait, no, he's not a bad guy. Did you know that the revolutionaries were the good guys, actually? Really shocking stuff.
turns out the evil state was evil.
It's like, and if the Hunger Games were like, the big twist is that there's going to be a revolution and they're the guys to support. And you're like, whoa, I wasn't ready for that. Jeez. So what the book does is the twist is so obvious that it doesn't even qualify as a twist. It just feels like the natural progression of the book, which makes it like a better twist than, say, like The End of the Bonesmith, where it's obvious, but it's just surprising enough to be like, come on, you just really wasted my time by not, you know, telling me this earlier. With Zayden, you're like, I already know that you're the good guy and that you're going to help lead a rebellion. It's not even a twist. It just feels like the character, it's like dramatic irony. I have more information than the main character does, and that's fine. But the actual big twist at the end is so sharp and shocking that my first response upon reading it was to go, whoa! Oh, maybe I should read the next book to... Wait, no, hang on a second.
So, I'm going to put the spoiler tag here. Drop off if you're done. You know that Dawn of the Empire is the next book. It's been great having you. So, the final twist is that Violet's brother is alive. And he joined the rebellion. And I saw this coming only a chapter before. So, good on them.
Well, good for you, Duncan. Because this was a complete surprise to me when it happened. And it did have that genuine effect. I'm being really serious when I say, oh man, that's exciting. Maybe I should read the next book to find out what happens. And then I went, hang on a second. No, wait, no, I'm being tricked. Because the whole point of that scene at the end is it's such a big bam, a big shocker that you're like, I have to know what happens next. And then you remember that it's just going to be more of the same, right? And from the sounds of things, from a lot of places, the same but worse. The next book from Lauren's description is not good, and I can't believe that I almost got tricked into buying into it, because whilst I did have a good time, I think I really have exhausted all of the enjoyment I can derive from Fourth Wing.
And to be honest, Geordie, although I feel like I had a better time than you, I'm in the same place. I do not regret reading Fourth Wing. And you know what? I wouldn't go around I wouldn't not tell people to read it. I'm not going to get down my knees and recommend it. But if someone's like, oh, I heard about Fourth Wing, should I give it a go? And I was like, listen, if you've read Core Thorns and Roses, which I'm just going to drop here, I thought was a better book, and that's, you're into that.
Yeah.
I'd give it a go. Roll the dice. Like, make your own mind up. But I don't need to continue.
And you asked me at the start of this episode, Duncan, that, like, how does this compare to The Bonesmith? And what I have to say about this is almost the exact same thing, just with a ever so slightly more positive spin, which is that if you don't read a lot of books, you want to start reading books, this would be a really great choice, and a better choice than Bonesmith, because this book is just more fun, it's sillier, it's crazier, it just does everything more. You know, it's the action is more exciting, it's more violent, it's more sexual, it's more passionate, there's more swear words, it's just a bigger book. Likewise, if you are an experienced reader and you read a lot of books already and you've read stuff like Fourth Wing already, then you don't need to read this one. Your time would be better spent with another book, which is just better and is going to be more worth your time, because it's a long book. You could probably spend your time better than this.
So, I think in conclusion, it's down to you, as kind of always. If you've read Fourth Wing and feel like we've given it a short thrift, or you reckon actually, you know, we're being a bit gentle on it, let us know. The best place, as always, is on our Instagram, It's a Fantasy Podcast. You also can hit us up on our Gmail, itsafantasypodcast@gmail.com, and we're also on Blue Sky @justfantasy. Join us next time for Empire of the Dawn, the final in the Empire the Vampire trilogy. I am so excited for it, Geordie. I cannot wait to tackle this with you.
Oh, you know what? I didn't say this. I normally bring this up. If you're going to experience this book, I would recommend the physical book over the audiobook. I did both for this time. The map at the front of this book was helpful. I really got confused a lot when I was listening to it. I was really lucky, though, because I listened to the audiobook via Spotify. Spotify only gives you 15 hours of audiobook time per month, which is about half the length of this book. But exactly halfway through me reading this book, we rolled over into the new month and I got another 12 hours. So I was able to listen to the entire book via audiobook without paying a dime for it.
I mean, that just sweetens the deal.
All right, Duncan, I look forward to seeing you next time for Empire of the Dawn and finding out how that story ends. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
So long.
Bye.